This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashran Johan. The 15th general elections, G15, is on the horizon. If parliament is dissolved earlier than expected due to political maneuverings and other reasons, experts say that elections could be held this year. If it doesn't, then we are less than 12 months away from parliament dissolving automatically anyway. The question is, how exactly is Malaysia doing right now politically? Joining me on the show today to unpack this is Dr. O.A. Sun. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. Welcome to the show, Ehsan. A lot has happened politically in Malaysia over the last 4 years. We're talking about a change in administration, a change in government for the first time in Malaysian history. Subsequently, we had Langkah Sheraton and then two different administrations post-Langkah Sheraton. How do you reflect and analyze these past 4 years? How is Malaysia doing politically?
Well, it is interesting that you use the Malay term Langkah, which means move, because to me, the last 4 years was indeed like the Argentinian dance, a tango, right? And as we say, it takes two to tango. So I think over the last 4 years, there's this tango between, shall we say, the more progressive and the more regressive political forces in the country. In 2018, we elected what we thought was a more progressive front to become the new government of Malaysia. There was a lot of hope. There was a lot of, at least proposals for reforms and so on. But of course, as the progressive forces made the move forward, well, the regressive forces were not quite happy about that, and they regrouped. And in less than 2 years, they were able to snatch away the popular mandate and thereby form a new government. So now it's regressive forces making the forward move. But I think moving forward, you will see this kind of tango again between the progressive and regressive forces still going on for quite some time to come.
What has been the impact of these times of uncertainty, this political turmoil, not just on democracy, but on the everyday lives of Malaysians?
Well, it is most unfortunate that as our political drama unfolds, we were also hit by the coronavirus pandemic, right? So number one, there was a lot of sad stories of people suffering and dying. And number two, as a consequence of the pandemic, the economy is definitely not doing well. There's indeed a sort of urgent need to sort of revive the economy. But because a lot of our senior politicians, I think they're engrossed in power struggles, you know, to see who can become the next prime minister and so on. And therefore, I think perhaps there's a lack of attention even on what we previously would consider very mundane things. For example, I grew up in Sabah having all these blackouts very frequently. Right. And then for those of you in Malaya, of course, it's less frequent. But it's quite amazing. Yesterday afternoon, you had this blackout in KL. The same evening, I was hit by another blackout in Kota Kinabalu. So you see, nowadays, what you took for granted as infrastructural amenities, because of the neglect, because of the autopiloting and so on, you would see it sort of break down more often. I think on both sides of the political divide, there was this scramble to the top because, well, our political system is such that, you know, who gets to be the leader of a coalition, and if that coalition happens to command a parliamentary majority, then they will become the government, and the guy at the top will be the prime minister. That's why you see on the opposition as well, with Anwar and various other opposition leaders trying to be, well, the number one one opposition leader. And on the government side, of course, is the PM price, right? So yeah, there's this scramble. But I think this is nowadays, like we talk about the a variant of the coronavirus, right? I think this is a variant of what we call, I think in socioeconomic terms, resource curse.
Right.
Namely, you know, we are endowed with so much and so plentiful natural resources. It is very tempting for example, the elites to get their hand on commanding and controlling these resources. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say to enrich themselves, but certainly to make sure all their friends and so on are well off.
Right. And many experts have questioned, I think you yourself have done it, many other political experts have questioned the leadership skills of both post-Lanka Sheraton prime ministers. And I'm talking about Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, as well as the current prime minister, Dato Sri Ismail Sabri. In a time of crisis and also opportunity, our country feels like it's running on autopilot with no vision backed with concrete policies to propel us forward. Would you say that this is a fair assessment? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you see, our previous prime minister and the current one, they are certainly very skillful politicians, but that necessarily means that they are very good in politicking, in scrambling to the top of their party's leadership or to the coalition's leadership, such that they become prime ministers. But perhaps what they could improve upon is indeed administering the country better. You know, you have previous prime ministers like Tun Razak, like Dr. Mahathir, and even Najib, you know, with all his blemishes. You know, these are visionary leaders, and they have a certain degree of charisma. They were able to sort of empower a group of very smart advisors in order to devise something which could, for example, in the present case, revive the economy and so on. You perhaps don't quite see that with the previous as well as the current prime ministers. But I think it's not too late if they could indeed sort of recruit some of the more thoughtful and skillful people, planners in the country. Hopefully, it could be for the better. Yeah.
Ihsan, we've talked a lot about voter disillusionment since Lanka Sheraton happened. And this has been reflected in the very, very poor voter turnout in every subsequent state elections over the past couple of years. But this doesn't seem to be a problem unique to Malaysia when we look at the current juncture of time we are in right now. In the 2020 US presidential elections, for example, and this was at the height of, you know, people's either massive support for Donald Trump or massive hatred for Donald Trump. But even then, you know, their voter turnout was merely at 62%. The recent French elections, where again, we're talking about a global pandemic, economic crisis, even the likes of Emmanuel Macron, he isn't as popular as he used to be. Then you look at the French elections, it only a 48% voter turnout. Is it fair to say, Ihsan, that people in Malaysia and in many parts of the globe are losing faith in electoral democracy? They are asking questions like, why participate and legitimize a system that doesn't benefit the people in any meaningful way anymore?
Well, there's a certain degree of that going on. Mm-hmm. But of course, there's also the overriding pandemic reason, right? People were scared of congregating, lining up in the long lines and so on.
Right.
But you see, traditionally, in more developed societies and countries, voter turnouts tended to be lower. This is because, well, they are by definition developed countries, right? So there's not much else to develop upon beyond, you know, whether you would one party would give more welfare, the other party would stress on defense and so on. These are very sometimes philosophical and ideological concerns. Whereas in traditionally in the developing countries, you see a higher voter turnout because, well, people, if indeed it's a real democracy, people would like to, you know, choose the government which could hopefully propel their livelihood forward. In our case, I think one reason is, of course, well, people voted in the government in 2018, but then that mandate could be snatched just overnight. And people felt frustrated on that kind of inability to effect change, shall we say, structural inability to effect change, more than their disillusionment necessarily with, for example, oh, the oppositions also could not do a lot of things. The opposition barely had less than 2 years in power. It is unfair to judge them against the juggernaut of a 60 years, essentially one-party rule.
I take your point, but the thing is, many people's lives were not improved upon at all in 2 years. We're talking about whether it's low-wage workers, even middle-class, you know, people in the middle class. A lot of suffering happens in 2 years. I can see why many people have given up, you know, might as well just focus on my own work and not bother. Mindset is understandable.
Well, you are moving into a, you know, a house which was occupied by another family for 60 years. There will be a lot of, shall we politely say, heirlooms sort of strewn around, right? Before you could sort of redesign it to your, shall we say, architecturally minimalist design, then, well, I mean, before that, you will have to sort of hire people to sort of move those things away and to do cleanups and so on. So that would take some time. It's not an overnight, you know, overnight change. And let us not forget our wonderful civil service. They are also in tune for more than 60 years with the power that be, and there is a certain degree of resistance from there as well. All this could not be changed in just 2 years. You should give them at least two terms, like 10 years. I mean, you saw this in Taiwan, you saw this in Korea, and so on. And then there will be a healthy change of governments. It could even regress back to you know, the previous government for another 10 years or so before changing hand again. But you could not just give it 2 years and say you did nothing. They have barely time to clean up the mess before they could do their own design.
On the show with me today is Dr. O.A. Sun. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs, and he's helping me unpack how Malaysia is doing right now politically. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. O.A. Sun. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs, and we're discussing how Malaysia is doing right now when it comes to politics. So, O.A. Sun, one of the ways lawmakers are trying to improve voter confidence and strengthen the system is the anti-hopping law. The law is currently being debated in Parliament. What are your thoughts on the anti-party hopping law that's being debated? And do you think it will improve voter confidence?
Well, in philosophical principle, I'm surprisingly actually against it, because I think it is against freedom of political association, that members of parliaments, they should be free to choose whichever party they want to affiliate with based on their conscience and ideology, which is often the case when we see even in advanced countries, advanced democracies, MPs switching sides because they felt that, you know, the ideology is no longer in sync with the original party. In this country, however, of course, a lot of elected representatives, they jump because, you know, because of their jumping, a new government could be formed and they could be rewarded as ministers or with other sorts of projects and goodies. Because of this sort of pervert forms of jumping, therefore, I would reluctantly agree that we do need the anti-hopping law. But you see, the latest version of the anti-hopping bill For example, if an MP is fired by his or her party, or he or she would not be having their seats vacated. So imagine if I'm an MP, yes, nominally I still stay with party A, but I publicly declare, and in parliament I will also vote for party B, especially party B's leader to be prime minister. Then my own party A could do nothing about me, because I'm nominally still with party A. Even if party A fires me, my seat is still held by myself.
But do you think that this anti-party hopping law, does it give back some power to the people? Because I take your point about, the freedom of association angle, right? But at the same time, the freedom of association of a lot of times, whether in Malaysia, sometimes even in developed countries, takes place without consulting the constituents, without the constituents' approval and things. It may not be the will of the constituents. Whereas for this, it's like you step out of, you switch parties. It doesn't mean you cannot be an MP anymore, but they'll trigger in elections and then constituents will then decide, should I retain you as an MP regardless of which party you're on? Or like, no, I don't align with the ideology. I align with the ideology of the party. So I'm going to put someone else from that same party who is not you anymore. Do you think that this new bill, while it does have its flaws as well, do you think it democratizes power towards the people a little bit more?
Yeah, I agree. MPs who in essence switch parties or becoming independents and so on, they should have their seats vacated, but they could still run in the same seat, as a candidate. And if the people like them so much as to re-elect them, well, then they could be MPs again. I'm okay with that. I'm just not okay with some suggestions that they should be barred from running for life and so on. Yeah,
absolutely. So strengthening democracy, right? It's only meaningful when it actually helps people achieve equity. So more than say anti-hopping law and other similar reforms that has been discussed about, setting two-term limits for the prime minister, so on and so forth. These are all important. But more than that, do we as a nation need a radical shift in mindset and philosophy when it comes to the way the economy is run? I mean, wages in Malaysia, for example, is so incredibly low. And it's not because the country is country as a whole is poor. It's because, the wages, there's no trickle down. The trickle down economics is not really working and so on and so forth. Many factors. Do we need to start thinking about the economy differently rather than saying that, okay, we'll just keep everything as it is, but we will clean it up a little bit more?
Okay, I think we need, number one, both political and economic reforms. Political mm-hmm. reforms, we talk about a lot just now, democratization, the various techniques for it. Now, in terms of the economy, sometimes it's more nuanced than it would first appear. Indeed, I think our pays and wages and salaries are very low. But if you ask foreign investors, for example, they would say, well, if you sort of improve your productivity, the productivity of the workers, then yeah, we are very happy to pay higher wages. Nowadays, Vietnam is becoming the regional darling for foreign investors. Right. Well, mainly because a lot of foreign investors felt that Vietnamese people work very hard, work very smart, and so on. And whereas in this country, if the same investors were to come to this country, a lot of our fellow citizens perhaps would not like to work in those companies or in those factories. And so the foreign investors would feel like, why don't I just go directly to Vietnam? Why would I go to Malaysia? And then having to go through a hassle of hiring foreign laborers. And then so we need to think through not only on higher wages, but our willingness to work in our own factories and companies instead of recruiting a lot of foreign laborers and so on. All this would need to be sort of tightened up in a package. That's why I say it's very important for whoever is in power to really have both practitioners as well as experts in this sort of social economic issues to try to really put together a reform proposal and package.
I want to hone in a little bit specifically on East Malaysia. When compared to the years before, have we begin to really democratize power to East Malaysia? You know, we talk about, let's say, MA63. And then if we zoom in on, let's say, Sarawak, you know, if you look at the current political landscape right now, let's say even if Barisan Nasional would like to form the government, they cannot do it without GPS support. GPS are essentially important kingmakers in Sarawak.
Well, I think undeniably, over the last few years, Sarawak especially, and to a lesser extent, Sabah, they, well, the term we usually use for it is fought for, right? They fought for and they won a lot of devolution of powers to the two East Malaysian states.
Right.
And indeed, as you see in Sarawak, almost every other day, there'll be some new programs being rolled out and so on. But, well, you still see some of the poorest districts in Malaysia locating primarily in Sabah, but also some in Sarawak. Of course, these are remotely accessible locations. But still, if more of these devolved powers could be used to improve the socioeconomic livelihoods of most of these residents of Sabah and Sarawak, I think it would be quite nice. But frankly speaking, I have yet to see that here.
I want to ask a sort of political party question in relation to that. When we look at what Warisan is doing right now, you know, their attempt to come to West Malaysia, try to contest in elections here and so on and so forth, which is not wrong. Fair game to them. After all, peninsula parties have for years and years, you know, run in East Malaysia as well. So the question is not about that, but rather, should Warisan have taken the GPS sort of approach and try to build a very strong grassroots support within Sabah so that they have more leverage when it comes to, you know, demanding things from Putrajaya, just like the way GPS is doing? Because GPS, they don't have seats in Peninsula Malaysia. And frankly, at least right now, it doesn't seem like they are even interested. They are like, we are going to really have power in Sarawak, but we're going to be kingmakers. Do you think Warisan should have taken that route instead with Sabah?
Well, I think number one, Warisan was trying to stake a claim on, well, survival more than anything else by coming to West Malaysia. And the momentum was strong for, let's say, 2 months. But with the resounding defeat in Johor, in the Johor state election, I think that momentum is unfortunately gone. I think their effort in trying to really make footholds in West Malaysia, I think from now on will be an uphill struggle. You see, GPS, or rather its component parties, they have a long-standing stranglehold in Sarawak, not less than BN in West Malaysia, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, they have that kind of incumbent advantage. For example, even during elections, sometimes, you know, only they have the accessibility to some of the more remote constituencies in Sarawak. And therefore, they have a stranglehold on the political support in Sarawak, especially when some of these constituencies are rather poor. In Sabah, however, Warisan came to power, well, little more than 2 years, slightly more than 2 years. They still don't have that kind of, you know, absolute stranglehold on power in Sabah. And then they were defeated in state election. So the reality of politics in Sabah and Sarawak is such that if you somehow are no longer in power, well, sometimes even your own MPs and state assembly persons would sort of leave your party. So they have to, in a sense, sort of create an impression that they are going to be great again and going to West Malaysia. So in order for them to keep even their own groups of MPs and state assembly persons, unfortunately, that was not quite successful here.
I want to pivot and talk about one last aspect, which is the youth movement, because there have been more and more protests in recent times. And most of these protests have been led by the youth and even university students. We're talking about like Mahasiswa protests and things like that. Are we at a point right now where our youth and student movements are becoming strong again, or we are trying to build it up again? Because there was a period, especially once Tun Dr. Mahathir came into power during his first tenure, and his approaches to politics, it really sort of stifled and you know, student movements all pretty much was very, very quiet for many, many years. Are we seeing a revitalization in terms of that? And I'm also wondering, what role will the youths play in shaping the results of GE15?
Well, number one, as you suggested, we used to have a very vibrant student movement in this country. Mm-hmm. People like Anwar Ibrahim, no less than Anwar Ibrahim, yeah. Or even our prime minister's own brother and so on. They were prominent student leaders, right? But nowadays, of course, you see younger generations, sometimes even pre-university students with their very adroit online skills and so on. So it's almost like during the pandemic times, they would combine online presence as well as offline physical protests and right. Do it in a hybrid manner and so on. So I think a lot of us are still observing whether how far this sort of hybrid mode of protest could go on. Because keeping in mind these are almost necessarily more urban-oriented activities, would they be able to penetrate some of the more rural constituencies where, in this country at least, I think more than 60% of our parliamentary constituencies are more or less rural in nature, whether it could penetrate to those rural communities, I think remains to be seen. Let us also not forget there's equally another group of shall we say, students. They might hold very strongly to their, shall we say, not so progressive mentality and ideology, but they do not quite come out. But during election time, some of the parties in this country may be able to mobilize them to come out to vote in quite large force. Yeah.
Before we wrap this conversation up, Ihsan, I would like some final thoughts from you. Where is Malaysia right now politically? How are we doing?
Well, to me personally, and honestly, and after observing so many modern political movements, shall we say, since the Second World War, I think we are approximately like Iran and Afghanistan in the 1970s, before 1979, where respectively they changed government. Or some people would compare us to pre-1982 Lebanon, where people are still living happily, but then there was the Israeli invasion. And of course, the more recent example is Sri Lanka. I wouldn't say we are descending to the level of Sri Lanka, but if we are not careful, if we still indulge in this sort of political power struggle at the expense of really thoughtful socio-economic reforms and so on, it is not impossible that we could slide down the so-called slippery slope into the not so nice consequences for some of these countries. Yeah.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today. That was Dr. O.A. Sun, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check us out on podcast. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcast from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.